accession number 19891, reel 3.
Bill Adams, reel 3.
I can't remember his name, but he later became the United Nations General in charge of Cyprus when they were making dividing lines between Turks and Greeks at the beginning of the Cyprus Troubles. He lived next door to me and had the bungalow next door to me, and he was a very, very fine man.
Where did you say you went to after Quetta, to Pune?
After Quetta, I went to Pune to be an instructor in the tactical school. And it was very off net. We were teaching desert warfare, which, of course, Pune was a very suitable place to do it, and giving very scant attention to jungle warfare. And suddenly, after about 3 or 4 months, we were uprooted and sent to Dehradun in the jungle, where we really got down to teaching jungle warfare. The commandant was a brigadier from the Cameronians who'd commanded his battalion in Burma, but wasn't a man of tremendous forward-looking. They'd sent out a new assistant commandant from England, a chap called Stewart, who was commanded a battalion in Malaya of Argyles, and was again a very, very forcible character, and he really got down to making us work out how to teach jungle warfare. It was fascinating serving under him. I spent the time building Japanese bunkers, and then we attacked them with tanks and with flamethrowers, and the whole thing was very much on the right lines, and it was the first time that people had really got down to teach jungle warfare.
How did the Japanese construct their bunkers?
Tremendously heavy construction, using big trees from the jungle. They'd felled the trees and then made a sort of grid of them, and then covered them with feet of earth. And you literally couldn't do anything with them. I mean, a tank firing at them was just useless. The earth absorbed the force of the shot, and the trees didn't splinter under the weight of the shot. I think they tried in the end, I can't remember the details very concisely, but I think they put solid shot to try and get it through the loopholes. And the thing that was most effective were flamethrowers, where from about 20 or 30 yards away, you aimed a flame through the loophole of the bunker. But the number I constructed and then which we tried to destroy was endless. It had been the jungle we were in had been the Viceroy's personal block, which was full of game in a big way. And after we'd been there for a week, there was no game for 50 miles. It had all disappeared. Tigers, deer, birds, everything.
Just frightened off?
Just frightened off, yes.
But this was real jungle, was it?
It was real jungle. It was one of the most sensible things the army did, actually, to move us up there and do this. And while I was there, we had an exercise at which we were allowed to creep in the back row, where the army command, the commander-in-chief himself, and General Gifford, who was commanding ELSI, came down and worked out the tactics for how they were going to invade Burma in 1944. And we made a great sand model representing the north of Burma. And everyone came to it who was, who, I can remember Peter Fleming coming and giving the intelligence summary of where the Jap forces were, and General Gifford speaking. Slim was there, Auchinleck was there, Bernard Ferguson and Mike Calvert was there. Wingate had been killed by then in the aeroplane accident. But everyone who was everyone came to this exercise, and they did a sort of mock invasion of Burma.
Any memories of Peter Fleming?
None, except he gave a very clear account of what the sort of intelligence situation was in Burma, where the troops were and that sort of thing. I think he must have been a G1 intelligence at Army headquarters. I was rather awed by the whole proceedings, actually, because I'd never seen so many generals in my life before. And it was quite a privilege to sit in the back row and listen.
Who particularly impressed you at this meeting?
Gifford didn't. I remember that. Slim said very little, but he obviously was very impressive. Auchinleck, of course, I had a tremendous feeling for. I think every Indian Army officer thinks the world of Auchinleck and how badly treated he'd been. But shall I tell you an anecdote about him?
If you would, please. Yes.
General Ian Jacob, who was Churchill's assistant, I got to know very well later, because he started life as a Bengal sapper, and he used to come to our reunions, and I got to know him very well. And of course he was a marvellous character. He became Director General of the BBC later, if you remember. When Auchinleck died, there was a sort of scheme to have a memorial to him in St Paul's Cathedral, but the dean and chapter weren't very keen, and everywhere we went no one was particularly keen, and we were trying to debate at our annual general meeting how we could subscribe to a memorial for him and where it should be and so on. And Ian Jacob got up and said, I won't subscribe a penny to him, or words to that effect, and said it in a very forthright manner. And it absolutely killed the discussion, because we all had a tremendous respect for Ian Jacob, and on the whole he was a gentleman and didn't sort of speak in a forthright manner. And so I was very intrigued as to how this had happened, and I then discovered that Ian Jacob had taken the letter from Churchill out to Auchinleck sack Auchinleck and replace him with General Alexander and Montgomery. Ian Jacob had obviously formed the opinion that Auchinleck wasn't as good as we Indian Army people thought he was.
Had he been rude to him?
I think he had. Auchinleck inspected my company at Roe Key. Archie Jack was away, I think, and I was commanding the company, and Auchinleck was our company commander in our district commander in Meerut. This was in 1939, and he'd just been summoned home to take Southern Command at Salisbury to be the general in charge. And when he inspected my unit, he stopped at the first man and said, "What's your name?" And the chap said, "Bishan Singh," or words to that effect. And he said, "Where'd you come from?" And the chap mentioned a village in Ludhiana district. And Auchinleck said, "Well, how's Subadar Kotar Singh?" And the chap's face lit up, you see, and you couldn't stop him talking for about 2 minutes. And Auchinleck passed on to the next man, and the next man was a Muslim who came from further north near Jhelum. And again, he said, "What village do you come from?" And the chap mentioned a village in Jhelum district. And Auchinleck said, "How's Jemadar so-and-so?" And the same thing again. And my company couldn't stop talking about it for about a fortnight afterwards. They'd never met a general before who knew all their friends. And he had the most tremendous respect from the Indian other rank. He was a unique character, Auchinleck. I know a little about him because my cousin, this medical general, used to go fishing with him in Norway, salmon fishing with him, and he had a tremendous respect for him. We all did.
So you're an instructor in jungle warfare at Dehradun. What happens next?
Well, then I got posted back to Roki to be senior instructor of fieldworks. It was a major's appointment, and I'd had enough. And so I went to my brigadier and said, I don't want to do this. I want to go on. It's time I went on active service. And he agreed with me and said he couldn't help me. It was a sapper thing. And so I said, "Well, have you got any other ideas?" And he said, "Well, send a letter to the commander-in-chief complaining." And so I wrote to Auchinleck, passed a letter through the normal channels, saying, "Could I be sent on active service and not take up this appointment as senior instructor of fieldworks at Roa Key?" And I got no answer, of course. But a month later, when I went down to Roa Key to take up the appointment, the commandant met me and said, "I'm giving you a field company in Burma." And so the letter had obviously gone through the channels and taken effect.
What happened next then?
Well, I then had the most enjoyable 6 months I've ever had in my life. I was given a company in Burma, a 75 field company, Bengal Sappers. And when I reached them, they were on the Chinrin, and they'd just been doing the bridging to ferry 19 div across the Chinrin at a place called Nong Yut. I may have got that wrong. And the previous commander of the unit disappeared, and we were told to take the bridging equipment down the river to Kalewa, which was about 110 miles to the south. And so we packed all our equipment up. I think we had a couple of lorries, and the second in command took them round by road. But the rest of the company went down on these ferries, and we loaded all our equipment on it. And we all set off thinking it was going to be a picnic and have an enjoyable week sort of boating down the Chinrin. In actual fact, it was an absolute nightmare, a very enjoyable nightmare, but we hadn't realized that the Chinrin, where we crossed the Chinrin, it was nice and deep. It was about 500 or 600 yards wide, and it was lovely. We thought the rest of the river would be like that, but we ran into rapids and shallows and all sorts of things. And would you like another story now?
Please.
This is a stupid one, actually. But going down Round Rapid, we had a motorboat, and I was on the motorboat. And one of the ferries hit a tree, which was in the river, and it made a hole right in the middle of the boat, and the boat sank in the middle of the rapids. And of course, none of the chaps could swim, and there was an absolute pandemonium while we got the chaps on shore, and the other chaps had got through the rapids. And we then had a look at the situation, and we had a jeep on board this ferry, this folding boat thing, and we managed to get the jeep on shore unharmed. It was my subadar, who was a Hindu, was a very good man at field works, and I've forgotten exactly how we did it, but it was quite a task and very enjoyable. But I'd noticed in one of the kit bags of the men there a little Buddha. I think it was about that size. Reconstructing the story afterwards, we'd harboured for the night nearer Punjichong, some of the Juwans had obviously gone into it and looted this Buddha from the Punjichong, and they put it in the top of their kit bag. And my subadar came to me in the evening when all was quiet, and we'd salvaged everything we could, and we'd made camp there and were preparing to go on. And he said, "Sam, did you see the Buddha?" And I then remembered that out of the corner of my eye, I'd seen the Buddha at the top of this kit bag, but it hadn't made any impression on me. I should have done something about it straight away, of course, but I was thinking of other things. But as soon as the subadar mentioned it, I remembered it. And he said, "Sorry, I'm telling you this, but please don't sort of think me wrong. Did you see what happened to it?" And I thought a bit, and then I thought a bit more. He said, "Sahib, did you see it swimming away?" And I said, "Yes, I did." And he said, "So did I." And he said, "That's why we hit the tree." It's a good story, isn't it?
It is. Is it Punjichong a temple?
A temple, yes. But anyhow, it took us about 8 days to get down to Kalewa, and we handed the equipment over to the bridge had just been built across the Chinrin there. I think it was about 1,100 foot long. It was a pontoon bridge, and we handed the our equipment over to them, and we then trekked off down the road to Kalemo, and we then did road works down the I think it's the Gungor Valley to enable Four Corps to get down to Pakoku, where they crossed. And it was very hard work, just making the track suitable enough to get the tanks through. And for a time I had an elephant company under command, of about 100 elephants, which had one officer, and the elephants were used for making crib bridges across sandy chongs. There was no water in the wadi, but the tanks couldn't go through it because the sand would have churned them all up. You know, the transporters couldn't drive through these things, and so the elephant company made practically solid timber bridges, and the elephant sort of pulled the tree out by its roots, sort of trees about that sort of thick, and then with their trunk they maneuvered it to the bridge site, and they pushed with their feet the tree into the right position. And from what I can remember, we had a gang of coolies who then drove spikes in to hold the whole thing together. And of course, it all got washed away when the monsoon came. But until the monsoon came, it was the most efficient way of getting tank transporters across these quite wide chongs. And the elephant company had one officer, a captain. He obviously must have been an expert with elephants. And there was one mahout to every two elephants. And it was an absolute joy watching them work. Sort of a scene interlude during the war. But we got away from these sort of chungs in the end. We got bit up into the hills. And I don't know what happened to the elephants. I went on an attachment to the Belgian army later when I got home in the early 50s. And they asked me about war in Burma. And I told them about these elephants. And they simply didn't believe me.
What other memories have you got from this time?
Well, then we then we got down to the river, my company had been very good at outboard motors, and outboard motors were an absolute curse at that time. Nobody could deal with them. They were always breaking down, and no one knew how to repair them, and that sort of thing. But the previous commander of the unit I'd been in had been an engineer with Listers of Dursley, and Listers of Dursley are an international firm who make small engines, sort of engines about that sort of size, for all sorts of purposes, you know, wells, firefighting, every purpose in the world, and all different sizes. And my second in command was a chap called Ken Sink, who was a South African. He'd been a tea planter, but he'd been more interested in the little factory that you have on a tea plantation than in the actual sort of growing of tea. And he was a very fine mechanical engineer. And he and chap from Dursley had worked out a system of how to look after outboard motors so that they didn't break down. And it was absolutely unique. My company knew exactly what to do with outboard motors, and they never broke down. It was just a fact of life. My CRE knew this and said we ought to do the assault crossing of the Irrawaddy. And so he sent me off to the CRE of 7DIV, who had been detailed to do the crossing, said Adams ought to provide the outboard motors. But poor old Tom Wright, who was a very solid sort of chap, didn't believe that anyone could do it better than his own people, and so we weren't chosen. And as a result, the assault crossing was a shambles. The outboard motors all broke down during the crossing, and there was one Japanese machine gun on the other bank, and it found where the assault boats were drifting about, you see, with no method of propelling them, and there were tremendous casualties, both amongst the sappers, and I think the battalion doing the assault was the East Lancashire Regiment, who I knew the OC very well because I'd met him at Dehradun. And luckily, one or two boats got ashore, and they were able to mop up this solitary Japanese machine gun. And eventually, they established a bridgehead. But it was very unfortunate that it happened. It wouldn't have happened if my outboard motors had been used. And I say that not to puff up myself, but simply because my Juwans knew how to do it. And I don't think there were very many Juwans in the Indian Army at that time who could run outboard motors. And it was due entirely to this chap from Listers and Ken Sink, my second in command. But anyhow, when we got to the river, the assault troops had got across, but then the whole transport of four corps had to get across. And the Irrawaddy in that part of the world changes course a lot and runs through great sort of sandy areas. And so there are great areas of sandbank. and areas of river. It's all very clearly described in the article I wrote in that little book about Tales from the Burma Campaign. And the Sangwals, the place where they chose to cross, was the right answer from the point of communications. But you had to get across about a quarter of a mile of sand. And the Sommerfeld track, which was going to make the roadway, hadn't arrived. And so it was all hands to the pump to sort of pull down palm trees and get vegetation so that we could make a solid base to get across this sandy area, which took about a day. And when we'd got a firm roadway across it, we then had to make little jetties to which the ferries could work. And so though the troops were on the other side, they sort of couldn't get reinforcements for about a day because of all this preparatory work which had to be done. And then I think there were 10 field companies doing the crossing, and it became like a regatta. You couldn't ferry at night, you see, because they'd have broken down and they wouldn't have known where they were. The Irrawaddy was about a mile wide and they'd have just drifted downstream and got out of the way. So we ferried from first light to last light, and literally dusk falls really suddenly. And as dusk all came down like that, we had to stop. And literally we were there before the morning dusk arrived, getting the first ferry off. And my company was I think they had sort of pontoon rafts, which had propulsion units on them, which are a rather bigger thing than an outboard motor. And it took an hour for the sortie to take the to take the thing across to the other side and get back. Because the Irrawaddy was throwing quite a good lick, and it was quite a journey. And let me think a bit more about it now. Of course, they needed maintenance, because I think it took about a week to get the two divisions which were crossing and the core troops across the river. And you can't run outboard motors and propulsion units at full lick for a week and not expect something to go. And they established a REME unit on the bank to do the maintenance. And the idea was when your engine broke down, you took it there and it was repaired. But in fact, it wasn't. You eventually got some other unit, some other propulsion unit, and it was quite obvious to me that the whole system didn't work. And so, without permission, I established my own scheme. Ken Singh took a spare pontoon out into the middle of the river and anchored it. And as each of our rafts passed, he took one of the engines off. He had a motorboat, you see. Took one of the engines off, put it into his little workshop, which is...